You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in Berlin. Daniel, where are we?
We're in the Schwarzer Pumper, the Black Pump.
Which is a bar, jolly nice bar. Are we in East Berlin or West Berlin
now?
We're
in the East. You're behind the Iron Curtain, Lionel.
I like it here. It's good. There's a really nice sort of retro feel, isn't there? It's like the days when the Soviets and the East German cycling teams used to dominate the peace race and the Olympic Games and all that.
It's very cool. Is it always like this, Daniel?
Has been for the last week, Richard. Yeah, we've got a long, hard winter ahead of us, I think. Could get as low as minus 20.
Wow.
Oh, wow. Well, we are here. I'm Richard Moore, Lionel Burney.
Hello.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
We're just over visiting Daniel. Maybe we'll come here every week and do the podcast.
Well, with the exchange rate the way it is, that will be a fast-track visit to oblivion for
Friends
us, I think.
Friends rate going up next year, I think, perhaps. We're here in Berlin. We're doing the podcast. We've got a lot to talk about with the World Championships, the ongoing Wiggins saga, latest updates on that in part three. But let's start with the news roundup, please, Lionel.
Okay, well, let's rattle through some of the racing that's been going on. Before the World Championships got underway, there was Paris-Tours, and that was won by Fernando Gaviria of Etics Quickstep. He took a flyer in the final 500 metres, and to me, anyway, it was reminiscent of André Schmil's win in the 1999 Milan-San Remo. Anyone remember that?
I do, Lionel, but that was much further from the finish.
It was much further from the finish.
About a kilometre from the finish.
Oh, well, it wasn't reminiscent of André Schmil's win in the 1999 Milan-San Remo, but he really caught the rest of the sprinters by surprise, pulled off a bit of a coup, and surely has to be considered one of the sort of B-list favourites for the World Championship road race on Sunday. A few days before that, Sam Bennett of Ireland won the Paris-Bourges semi-classic, so he adds his name to the growing list of potential medalists for the road race in Qatar on Sunday. The Worlds are underway as quite a contrast to the chilly temperatures here in Berlin. It's been very, very hot and dusty, which perhaps shouldn't surprise people, seeing as it's being held in the desert. We'll talk about the racing in more detail in the podcast. I won't go through everything because we'll have nothing left to talk about from the time trials, will we? But in brief, Etics Quickstep won the men's team time trial, beating BMC Racing, who had won the title for each of the last 2 years. The women's team time trial was won by Bowles Dolmans, featuring Lizzie Deignan and Evelyn Stevens and Ellen Van Dyke, and that ended Canyon SRAM's dominance. They've won every edition up to now. America's Amber Naben won the individual time trial at the age of 41, a feat almost as impressive as her compatriot Kristen Armstrong winning the Olympic time trial at the age of 43, as she did earlier in the summer. Naben beat Dutch rider Ellen Van Dyke by just 6 seconds. Katrien Garfoot of Australia was third. And we have to mention Annemiek van Vleuten, who was the rider who looked set to win the Olympic road race in Rio before that horrible crash on a descent. She finished fifth in the time trial, which is quite a comeback in only a few weeks. It's probably only a couple of months, isn't it, since the Olympics. Tony Martin's won the men's time trial for the fourth time in his career, equaling the record held by Fabian Cancellara. He crushed last year's winner Vasil Kirienka of Belarus. Jonathan Castroviejo was the bronze medalist. The other standout performance was by Ireland's Ryan Mullen, who was in the hot seat for quite a lot of the day and eventually finished fifth. So the road races are coming up over the weekend. Away from the racing, Katusha have confirmed that the shampoo manufacturer Alpecin, formerly of Giant Alpecin, will be a co-sponsor of their team next year. So that will be Katusha Alpecin, and they'll be Swiss rather than Russian. And that means Giant Alpecin will be Sunweb Giant. We'll do an update on all of those team changes once the racing season has ended. William Fotheringham of The Guardian has today reported that La Course, which is the women's race held in Paris on the final day of the Tour de France, may expand to a multi-day event next year. And this afternoon, we've had confirmation that Yorkshire will host the 2019 World Road Race Championships. So that guarantees at least one rainbow over the Dales in late September in 2019.
Nice Lionel. Nice. Well,
He has been working on that last line, that payoff line, for about an hour. Anyway,
an hour at least. Yeah, tapping away there on his computer. It's all very, you know, it's always carefully scripted, isn't it? Your news roundup. It's just not just all off the cuff.
Well, it might surprise you, but it's quite hard to remember all of that stuff, you know. Anyway.
Well, you mentioned the time trial, the men's time trial this afternoon. Never seen Daniel so animated as while we were watching Tony Martin win his fourth time trial in very impressive fashion. Daniel, you were getting quite into that, weren't you?
Yeah, I felt the World Championship time trial this year really had the setting that event deserves, you know, very atmospheric, an atmosphere becoming of the spectacle itself. No fans, no trees, no vegetation, no nothing. No, nothing of any real interest.
Well, hang on a minute. It's not as if the public of Berlin have taken to the streets this afternoon to celebrate Tony Martin's victory. I was expecting...
Dancing, you know, in the streets.
Expecting Trabants out on the street, German tricolours waving, everybody honking their horns.
He's German, of course, Tony Martin.
Of course, yeah, very apt. But it's not been a great advert for cycling or the World Championships over in Doha. We weren't really expecting anything different, were we? I mean, I went to bed on Saturday night, woke up on Sunday and put the cycling on and thought I'd missed the whole winter and was watching the Tour of Qatar. It's got very much the same feeling as that, hasn't it?
Incidentally, do you know the story about Tony Martin's family escaping to the West before, just shortly before the war came down in 1989? It was just 3 or 4 weeks, I think, or a few weeks before the wall actually came down. They attempted and accomplished a heroic escape through Hungary. There was a rickety fence on the Hungarian border, which a lot of Germans, actually East Germans, poured through. And I think then they came back into West Germany via Greece or something fairly improbable sounding. And then just as they arrived in West Germany, the wall came down.
So they could just stroll back, collect their possessions, and then move back again.
Pretty much.
Excellent.
Well, yeah, I mean, fair, you know, Tony Martin probably rescued
fair play
to them. But no, he's rescued what has otherwise been a fairly disappointing season by his standards. I think some people might have even considered him a bit of a fading force.
Well, I was going to say, didn't we give him the fading force treatment at some point?
probably. He's not that old, is he, Tony Martin? 31. You know, and he proved today, I mean, that was a really convincing victory, 45 seconds over Kirienka, and he seemed pretty happy. I mean, he's not had a great season, and I think people were starting to write him off a little bit.
Yeah, he hasn't had a great season. He looked to be deteriorating as a time trialist. I think he won a time trial in the Algarve early in the season, but otherwise been fairly, well, below par in certainly the big prestigious time trials that he's taken part in. You know, heard murmurings about him not possibly being that satisfied with his equipment at times, and I think looking forward to next year when he's going to have different equipment at Katusha. But really, the highlights of his season came very early on in the classics, and you know, we wondered whether
he was trying to reinvent himself.
Well,
wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, and I wonder whether that his career will go in that vein over the next 2 or 3 years. I mean, Katusha have obviously got a pretty strong team in the classics with Christoph. Martin was impressive. He didn't get a lot of responsibility in the classics, obviously a very strong team, Etix Quickstep. But yeah, he looked to be back to his best today. I presume that gear choices were extremely important on such a flat course, and we saw a few riders who looked as though they might have got it wrong. Rowan Dennis perhaps being one of them. He does ride very big gears, but his gear today looked to be a bit too big. But Tony Martin does tend to go well on courses of that ilk, doesn't he? You know, the kind of course where we've seen him in the past use gears as big as 58-12, 58-11.
Just super strong. I mean, Ryan Mullen, you mentioned earlier, the Irish rider rides for Cannondale. He will be very happy. He was in the hot seat for a long time and ended up fifth. Really outstanding performance by him. We were watching him just before we started recording there. He's got a tremendous position on the bike. It's very low and very smooth, very straight back, and looks really good. That's a real sort of breakout performance by him.
Yeah, it certainly was. And, you know, a little bit unlucky in the end not to be on the podium, perhaps. But the people who beat him, you know, all established time trialists, and when you compare the result from the Olympic Games earlier this year and the result today, you know, a lot of the same names are up there. Obviously not Fabian Cancellara, who won the Olympic time trial but isn't racing here, or Chris Froome, who's not racing here, although you wouldn't expect Chris Froome to do anything on a course that flat, really, would you? I wouldn't have thought. But the other riders up there, Castroviejo, Bodnar, Rowan Dennis, you know, they were all in the top six in the Olympics as well. So you can't really argue that the best time trialist were well up there, and that, you know, Tony Martin, certainly one of the best time trialists of this generation. That's his fourth title, and he has won on a variety.
Seven world titles, if you include team time trials,
of course. Yeah, because Tony Martin and Nicky Terpstra, who were part of the Etics Quickstep team that won the team time trial on Sunday, were also part of the Omega Pharma team time trial winning teams that won in 2012 and 2013. So, yeah, a lot of medals there for Martin. I suppose the big disappointment in the men's time trial was Tom Dumoulin, who finished only 11th. Perhaps would have expected a better challenge for a medal, no?
Well, he tweeted afterwards that it's a big ask to maintain form from April through to October. And I think the Giro was a big thing for him this year, the Giro and the Olympics, wasn't it? And the Tour de France was a bit of a bonus after pulling out of the Giro. And, you know, it's maybe just having been in the shape he was in for the Giro in April, it's perhaps just asking a bit too much for him to hold that all the way to October, because we're, you know, it's a later World Championships than normal as well. So.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. You can, of course, watch the World Championships on Eurosport, the home of cycling. Lots of racing still to come until the Men's World Road Race Championship on Sunday, which we're going to talk about in a moment. But, of course, one of the big things in Qatar has been the heat, and there have been a few unfortunate incidents so far of riders clearly suffering in the heat and crashing and so on. Now, the team time trial was particularly bad, and a lot of people extrapolate from that the road races will be even worse. I would say that you go deeper in the team time trial than you would tend to go in a road race, and so I think the risks in the team time trial are perhaps greater than the road race. So we've maybe seen the worst of that, I don't know, but there's still a possibility, isn't there, that the road race, the men's road race on Sunday will be shortened.
Well, I think the factor is being out in that heat for 6 hours, and Daniel, you know, looking at the amount of water that the riders are going to get through, you had a stat from what the Italians are expecting their riders will drink in a 6 hour road race, and it's 20 bottles each.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a lot. You know, logistically that makes it quite difficult, doesn't it? I mean, most of the time they'll be getting the bottles from the pit on the circuit, but on the first 100 odd K out in the desert, they'll be relying on service from the team cars following, won't they? Something that they'll have to be, you know, keep right on top of. But I think the wider issue is that watching these events this week on TV, if you were a casual fan tuning into the World Championships, it looks like an irrelevance. There's nobody there. There's no crowds there. There's no sense of this is an elite sporting event. I mean, everyone mocked the Rio Olympics and how so many of the venues were empty, very few spectators at some of the sports. But this is not a great advert for cycling, is it?
It's embarrassing. I mean, it's you have to wonder what's the long-term goal of it. And, you know, you people at the UCI have justified it as soon as the decision was announced to take the World Championships to Qatar. You know, talked about promotion and, you know, widening cycling's appeal. And I actually think it's an area in which the UCI have deserved some credit over the last 15 years. You know, we've talked before about the work that's been done in Africa, and we've seen the fruits of that with MTN Quebeca, which have become Dimension Data, and generally the peloton becoming a lot more cosmopolitan, and you know, more interest from other countries, and you know, some of the credit for that has to go to the UCI. But it's very difficult to see any correlation, any likely correlation between World Championships and any groundswell of interest in Qatar, because there are simply not many people there, and it certainly hasn't captured the imagination of the you know, small number of people that do live in Doha.
And we knew that would be the case from the Tour of Qatar, where, you know, there's nobody out watching the race. Yes, it is embarrassing. It's farcical. And, you know, Qatar were up against Norway, Bergen in Norway, for the 2016 World Championships. Bergen have got the 2017 World Championships. But why on earth would the UCI award the World Championships to Qatar instead of Bergen? I mean, why would they do that? You can only think that there's financial reason for it, because there's huge support in Norway for cycling. There's been a World Championships there in 1993, of course, with Oslo. But, you know, we see at the Tour the numbers of Norwegian fans. There will no doubt next year be huge crowds out for the championships, and you think, well, if the choice back when the decision was made was between Norway and Qatar, Qatar was chosen purely for financial reasons, and that's not doing any favors to the sport at all, and to
no,
a showcase event.
And you would have to think that Qatar's bid would have or should have absolutely dwarfed the Bergen bid or the Norwegian bid several times over for you to be able to construct any kind of justification or any argument, because, you know, let's say the UCI had been able to pull in another 10 million euros as a result of going to Qatar, and they'd reinvested that money in anti-doping, and then you might say, well, fair enough. But I don't know the exact figures, but I presume that wasn't the case, and it seems like a very short-termist view. And, you know, as you say, Rich, you think about the image of the sport and you think about how it looks to the wider public, and growing it not only over the next couple of years but over the next 15-20 years. You know, Qatar really has had its chance to develop a culture of watching cycling. You know, the Tour of Qatar has been around for a long time now, and it hasn't really punched any kind of hole whatsoever, has it?
And when you consider if the stated aim is kind of globalisation, taking cycling to areas where, you know, it's likely to develop as a major sport, you see the crowds for the Tour of Eritrea and other races in Africa, and you think that surely would be far more...
It'd be tricky, I think, holding world championships in Eritrea.
Well, it may well be, but there may well be other areas of Africa where, you know, it'd be less tricky. Certainly, David. All right. Well, what I'm saying is areas where there's a passion for the sport that already exists, because surely, you know, if you're talking about growing the sport, you want to tap into that passion and expand it. And really, the bigger factor is that the riders themselves, and Tom Dumoulin made some comments that kind of alluded to his disappointment at racing in front of nobody. The riders themselves want prestigious events to ride. They don't want to turn up. And, you know, there are more people at junior Kermesses in Belgium than there have been at the World Championships in Doha. And that, regardless of the financial implications for the UCI, you know, that's not a good look for professional cycling at all.
I was at the 2013 Tour of Qatar, and on the final day in Doha, there was a sort of sprinkling of fans. And maybe there will be on Saturday and Sunday for the road races. I met a young guy who'd driven there from Saudi Arabia, you know, and he was a big fan of the sport and had a scrapbook with all his heroes in it, and, you know, really followed the sport very closely, and that was great. But there needs to be several hundred times more of that kid. You know, there were only a very few people there. And you can see, even just with one or two, that there's potential, but it's not, it's had a chance. It's been in... The Tour of Qatar has been going for, what, a decade or so now? They get really good riders, all the top teams every year, and it hasn't really generated a great deal of interest.
No, and you also wonder about other revenue streams as well. And, you know, does this perhaps show a lack of imagination or a lack of ability on the part of the UCI to create other revenue streams? You know, you think of a circuit where there might be 100,000 people, and, you know, the kind of merchandising you could sell, and, you know, in one of the cycling heartlands, you know, the UCI, are they not losing out on things like that? But yeah, it's really the long term view which is the important one, and you know we've seen, it's not as though there haven't been test cases. You know, Marc Madio had this big rant on French television on Sunday night about the World Tour next year and how it's going to be impossible for World Tour teams to honour every World Tour commitment they have and their domestic races. So Madia was saying, well, it's going to be impossible for us to enter a complete team into these important French races that have been around for 100 years. But he was also talking about, you know, races like the Tour of Beijing, and which, you know, we've seen time and time again. You export cycling, parachute it into a country with no cycling culture, and for it to have any kind of chance to flower, you need 15, 20, 30 years, and realistically, that's not going to happen.
Having said all that, what we have had in Qatar over the 10 years or so of the Tour of Qatar is some really cracking racing. And the paradox is that we could have a really good racing at the weekend with the road races. The time trials and team time trial, one thing, you know, against the backdrop of the desert, not a fantastic televisual spectacle, but the road races, they could generate really exciting racing. I mean, it's obviously flat, so it is on paper a sprinter's race, but there is, you know, with the national teams, there's with a lot of the teams having, in effect, being divided in two, almost French and the Germans in particular, well, French certainly, and without there being the established pattern of it being falling to one team to bring it back together, it's quite unpredictable. There could be crosswinds. It could be a race that favours. You mentioned Nicky Terpstra earlier. Guys like that who can excel in races where they can escape. We saw Gaviria as well pull something out of the bag at the weekend, something very unusual, attacking the way that he did, and not without leaving it to the sprint. It could be a really interesting race.
It could be, and the thing that will make it is the fact that there are rainbow jerseys on offer, and this is the one chance to get one this year, as it is every year. And regardless, you know, of the terrain, regardless of whether anyone's watching, it's still the World Championship Road Race, and that will, you know, that will save it. And there will be stories, and there will be talking points from the weekend. Not going to speculate about how the races might pan out, but there are a lot of things to look for. There's going to be, particularly in the men's race, you know, a big field dealing with potentially crosswinds, dealing with that heat, you know, the brake getting away, how much time will they be allowed? Who will take up the chase? Will it be like Copenhagen in 2011 when Great Britain did a lot of work for Mark Cavendish and really controlled the race and the other nations let them do it? Or, you know, it's in the interest of so many teams to ensure there's a sprint. But that, in a kind of odd way, presents opportunities to do something unexpected.
And you would have said the same about Paris-Tours on Sunday. And, you know, it was a fantastic win by Gaviria. But, frankly, there were lead-out trains mincing at 500 metres to go. They were actually mincing. And that happened because they were looking at each other, you know, who's going to take up the chase now? And the same definitely could happen. You know, there's almost a tipping point after which there are too many teams that want the sprint, and then they start looking at each other and say, well, you know, we all know what we want from this, but who's going to do it?
And it's rare. We've seen it with Italy before, where they've come in with a plan. They've ridden very strongly as a unit, as a team, and we saw it with Great Britain in 2011 in Copenhagen. But it's unusual, isn't it, for a national team put together with guys who are, you know, riding on rival teams the rest of the year. It's unusual for teams to really come together and really ride as a single unit. And, you know, the Germans are the sort of the big favourites, I suppose, with they've got Greipel, but they've got Kittel as well. And Greipel, I think, is a favoured leader. But how much is Marcel Kittel going to get, who I think is going really well? I mean, he looked really strong. He's not ridden well in terms of winning sprints recently, but he looked incredibly strong in the team time trial.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I mentioned it last week in the podcast. I had a chat with Mark Cavendish last week about Kittel and his chances, and he certainly felt that Greipel was a much better bet on this course with lots of changes of direction, potentially lots of changes in the wind, and he felt that you could kind of bully Kittel on a route like this, that there are lots of places where you're going to have to accelerate over the course of the 5-6 hours.
How is Cavendish? Is he ill, as reported?
I think his Dimension Data team manager, Rolf Aldag, felt that he needed a bit more racing. He was down to do the Munsterland Tour, and there was one more one-day race. He did ride Paris-Tours at the weekend, and he finished sixth, I think.
He was there. He was well-positioned at the end, but didn't seem to have the...
But there is a... I don't know, if you go back over the last few years, there have been multiple occasions when in the penultimate race before a big race, Cavendish has seemed to disappoint or flatter to deceive in sprints, and I think there has been an element of bluffing. I think that was certainly the case at the British National Championships this year, and I think some of it is quite conscious. You know, Adam Blythe beat him in a sprint in the British National Championships, and people assume that Cavendish wasn't going well. I'm not saying that he gifted Blythe the victory, but I think that he knows what he's doing, and he was going really well until he fell ill in the Giro di Toscana, was it a week ago? He had an illness which prevented him from training for about 4 or 5 days. But I think there's probably enough time has passed now for him to be completely recovered and to be going fairly well again.
Far better for him to be under the radar a little bit. I mean, nobody's going to let Fernando Gaviria do the same thing 2 weeks running, are they? They'll be keeping an eye on him in the final kilometres. But the fascinating thing about this race, with the course being so flat, getting to the circuits, there's nothing to say it won't fit the pattern of a world championship road race, and at 60, 70 kilometres to go, there won't be a really powerful, dangerous move containing some sort of, you know, some of those big hitters that you mentioned, Nicky Terpstra.
Possibility, yeah.
And who then marks that kind of move? Who then, suddenly you get eight riders up the road with a lot of horsepower. Nobody wants to chase if they've got a guy up there. So does the gap go up? You know, it's going to be really fascinating to watch how the riders tackle the course, and that's why I wonder whether a team like Great Britain will be looking to defer and make sure that they don't get lumbered doing all of that work like they did in Copenhagen, when they really were so on top of their game that day.
I imagine the most teams will have a sort of, you know, a plan B as well. You know, teams with sprinters. John Degenkolb as well is another, you know, presence in the German team, is a, you know, a bit of a dark horse. Is he somebody who can maybe sneak away in a break like that?
Yeah, and
that
Arnaud was certainly Demar as well.
Arnaud Demar,
French, yeah.
Well, we haven't spoken about the French.
Well, Buhani has actually said that it would be folly to split the team. It looks as though the team is split straight down the middle, and Buhani has got his guys there, and Demar has got his guys, and of course, there's history between the two because, you know, they didn't get on particularly well when they were both at La Française des Jeux, and then Buhani left, and it seemed to be a bit of a cold war between them. But Buhani said, no, if we ride at cross purposes in the world, it's going to be a disaster. So we're going to have to find a way of having one goal and both riding towards that one goal. So that sounds to me possibly as though Demar's the more versatile rider, probably better in the wind. He's perhaps going to be the guy, the opportunist. And Buhani,
or maybe Buhani's thoughts are that that one goal should be that Demar should ride for him.
Possibly. My favourite bit of speculation, Lionel, that I'm going to let you in on, comes from friend of the podcast, Filippo Pozzato, who in the Gazzetta dello Sport yesterday, or 2 days ago, and this is something that it's completely passed me by over 15 years of covering the World Championships, that there is the teams start in a grid at kilometre zero. So they're all lined up and they all have their position before the race, and Italy are 15th on the grid. And Pozzato was worried. He's a reserve for the Italian team at the moment.
He's shopping in Doha on Sunday.
Yeah, he was concerned that a team like Belgium, or a team who are very strong in the wind or in crosswinds, they might attack from the gun, thereby absolutely obliterating a team like Italy, who are 15th on the grid, or making it impossible for them to get back on. So if that's the case, we're going to have a cracking race from kilometre zero.
Well, you know me, I hate predictions, but I will make a prediction about Pozzato. I think he's going to get a very lovely watch, some jeans with kind of faded bits and zips on, training shoes,
white
several pairs,
shoes.
Lots of very white training shoes, yeah. Perhaps a jacket.
Okay, a couple of other dark horses. Elia Viviani is perhaps a good
54.
Shout for the Italians, if he can get up from 15th on the grid, if he's got time and over 260 kilometres to get himself to the front.
How many pit stops does he plan? The Italians plan. You have pits in there. You see, this is a bit of a theme, isn't it?
I mean, if there are crosswinds, if there is a wind, and we don't know, obviously, and it would be speculation to imagine that there will be. But the Dutch and the Belgians are the guys you look to. I mean, the Dutch have got Dylan Groenewegen, who's obviously in pretty good form, but young and might not last the distance. Who's the best sprinter in the Belgian team?
Tom Boonen.
Do you reckon?
Wow.
Tom Boonen.
At the end of a long race.
He's not going to win a bunch sprint, though, is he, if it comes down to a bunch sprint? So the Belgians are perhaps the team who we should look to really rip things up a bit and go in there with a plan that doesn't involve the race coming down to a bunch sprint.
Mm. I think let's just hope it's not a farce. Let's hope that the conditions are, you know, reasonable, fair. It's not blisteringly hot. We don't want to see riders, you know, suffering to the extent that they're, you know, on the verge of fainting in the final, you know, 50 kilometres, having been out there all day. Let's hope that the temperatures are, you know, moderate enough, and that we see a full race over the 260-odd kilometres and not a truncated one, because that would be a real shame. And I mean, that would make it probably a disastrous World Championship.
Who's going to win? We haven't mentioned Peter Sagan at all, the defending champion.
Oh, well, I mean, I've placed my bets.
Who's going to win, Lionel?
I backed Gaviria before he won Paris Tour for the World Championships, and I'm a little bit concerned. I think he's shown too much by pulling off that move. But, you know, he's still got a chance if it comes to a flat-out sprint. So I'll stick my neck out and say Fernando Gaviria.
I'll go left field and I'll say John Degenkolb. I know, it's just, I just thought...
Well, he's won a race recently.
Yeah, no, I think he's getting better and better and better. It might still be too long for him, given the season he's had, but... You know, as a sort of
German.
Yeah, as a sort of, you know, number two in the German team, and having perhaps a little bit of freedom, maybe.
They're all East Germans in the German team. All the big three are all East Germans.
Has there ever been a good West German cyclist?
Rolf Goltz.
Rolf Goltz.
Daniel, pick.
I'm going to go Cavendish, as I think is the favourite to win. I think Buhani. Because it would be ironic, poetic, thumbed nose at everyone and everything off the season that he's had. And, yeah, it would really set the cat amongst the pigeons. So I think that would be an interesting storyline if Buhani were to win.
And the women's race, I spoke to Hannah Barnes last week, of course, and quite a similar scenario there, that she is one of the riders who could get away in a little move, you know, while the team will be working mainly for defending champion, Lizzie Dagnan, as she's known now. She might have a chance. I'd like to mention Eileen Rowe, Scottish rider, very good sprinter, who her first ever World Championships, big moment for her, and it'd be nice to see her do well.
I will go Chloe Hosking.
Daniel?
Wild?
Kirsten Wild. Georgia Bronzini is the other one that that Hannah Barnes mentioned. Well, my pick, lads, I think, is Yolien Duur, the Belgian rider.
Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
So listen, the real reason for coming over to Berlin was we were bringing you a special package, weren't we, Daniel?
Ho, ho, ho.
Oh, well, special packages are in the news, aren't they, Lionel?
They are.
Would you like to give us a little update on the latest on the Bradley Wiggins? Well, it started as a Bradley Wiggins TUE story, yeah, but it's morphed into something else.
Well, it has morphed, and it's become a story that is running and running. So this all started with the revelation from the Fancy Bears group of hackers that Bradley Wiggins had been granted a therapeutic use exemption to use triamcinolone to treat his asthma before the 2011 Tour, the 2012 Tour and the 2013 Giro. But in the last week, the story's moved on a lot, largely because of a report by Matt Lawton of the Daily Mail, which alleged that Simon Cope took a medical package to Dr. Richard Freeman of Team Sky on the final day of the 2011 Dauphiné, which Wiggins won. Lawton's report also alleged that Wiggins had a consultation with Dr. Freeman in the back of the Team Sky bus after the final stage of that Dauphiné, which finished at La Toussuire in the Alps. Now, at the time, Simon Cope was a British cycling employee. He was manager of the British women's team in 2011, and now he's the boss of the Wiggins team. When Matt Lawton put these allegations to Dave Brailsford, the boss of Team Sky, Brailsford initially said that Cope had been travelling to Geneva to visit Emma Pooley. Pooley swiftly denied this, and in fact she was racing in Spain on that day, so you know, that sort of alibi kind of unravelled pretty swiftly. Brailsford also said that there was no way Wiggins could have had a consultation with Dr. Freeman in the Team Sky bus at La Toussuire, because the bus had left before Wiggins had finished his obligations on the podium with the dope control and so on after the stage. British Cycling have said to the Daily Mail that the package contained a medical substance, but they also said that that was not triamcinolone. Now, the reason that's important is because the TUE was not applied for until later that month. We're talking about June 2011 here. So if the package contained triamcinolone, that might suggest that Team Sky had already made up their minds about how all of this might play out before Wiggins had seen a specialist or actually got permission to use the drug. Cycling News have quoted Simon Cope saying that he didn't know what was in the package that he took to Geneva and then on to the Dauphiné. He's also said that it wasn't meant for Wiggins, it was just for Dr. Freeman. He said it was a jiffy bag that could have contained band-aids or nasal strips or pedals. And so we are currently in a situation where there's a lot of focus on what was in this package and no one is able or willing to say what it was.
Is it not also the case, Lionel, that Wiggins... had he been administered triamcinolone on the final day of the Dauphiné, even though the race had finished, that would have not been allowed. It's, you know, Quarantine has died out of competition, but even on the final day of a race, that would be considered in competition.
Yeah, in competition is defined by 3 days before an event and up to midnight on the at the end of the event. So, yeah, I mean, this is real speculation here, and there's no suggestion that Bradley Wiggins was given Triumph Cinelone on that final day of the Dauphiné. But had he been, yeah, that would have been against the rules. And so we're left in this situation where we're really none the wiser about what has gone on. But there is an awful lot of focus and questioning about this. We've had today the BBC's head of sports news or sports editor Dan Rowan has been at Manchester Velodrome and has tried to ask Dr. Richard Freeman some questions, which we gather he has not answered. And so we're in a position where this is a real PR disaster for Team Sky, and there are way more questions now than there were even a week ago.
And you, Lionel, have become part of the story, haven't you?
Well, I'm really trying not to become part of the story, Richard, but yeah, I was there at that Dauphiné in 2011. I actually travelled with Team Sky that week, covered the race, was kind of inside the team, if you like. I talked to Dr. Richard Freeman a lot that week, including about the sort of ethics and morality and practicality of applying for TUEs. I wrote a feature for Cyclesport magazine, which is still available on the internet. It's on the Cycling Weekly website. People want to read that. But one of the aspects of the therapeutic use exemption protocol that we talked about was regarding Rigoberto Urán, their Colombian rider, who I was told was suffering with breathing difficulties, was struggling with his allergies, and Dr. Freeman was trying to get in touch with the UCI's doctor, Mario Zorzoli, to get an emergency TUE to allow some treatment for Urán for the final few days of the race. And we had a conversation, which is in the article that I wrote, about, you know, whether or not it's appropriate or right that riders should apply for medical assistance if they're too ill to ride. And we talked about the ethics of that. On the final day of the Dauphiné, which went to La Tussuire, I was in the Team Sky car with Nicolas Portal, who was a sports director, Dr. Freeman and Tim Kerrison, and we were following the gruppetto on the final climb, and we drove in after the final riders, and the final group were outside the time limit, at least half an hour down. And the reason I've become a sort of incidental player in this is because I feature in a video which was taken after the finish of that stage. Bradley Wiggins is giving interviews outside what looks very much like the Team Sky bus, which is still there at La Tussuire. It hasn't gone off, as
Black
Dave
bus
Brailsford.
With Team Sky written on it.
Well, Dave Brailsford said initially to Matt Lawton that Wiggins couldn't have met with Dr. Freeman in the Team Sky bus because the bus had already left and had gone off to take riders elsewhere. And that didn't ring true to me. If I was in court, I couldn't swear what time the bus left or when. But certainly I arrived at La Tussuire a good 30 minutes after the Wiggins group. And I remember waiting there to speak to Bradley Wiggins to get his reaction to winning the Dauphiné. So as far as, you know, I'm concerned, that footage of Wiggins and I'm in the edge of the frame and the Team Sky bus is there. On the grassy knoll, indeed. I mean, so really the questions there are, why did Dave Brailsford reach so readily for alibis, citing the bus and citing Emma Pooley, when those alibis don't check out? And it's a real muddy issue now. And Team Sky have kind of gone to ground. They are now saying that they can't comment any further because there's a UK anti-doping investigation into this whole thing. And that's kind of quite a helpful shield for them. It means that they can step back, detach themselves from this for now. But the mainstream media is
the mainstream media are all over
this go.
The media are all over it. It's hell of a story because, as you say, the focus now is on the apparent untruths and the things that don't stack up in this story, and the focus is obviously is what was in the package. And it, you know, it's not good. Paul Hayward wrote a very good piece, I thought, in the Telegraph. I tweeted it a day or so ago. You can't sort of emerge and offer some facts but not all of the facts. And I think, as we said in our initial podcast about this a couple of weeks ago, the way to have addressed this was to come out immediately or as soon as possible after the Fancy Bears hack for Bradley Wiggins to release his medical records. He can release his medical records. You know, everyone's right has a right to medical confidentiality, but is hay fever, is a pollen allergy so sensitive that asthma, so sensitive that you can't release medical records pertaining to that? I don't understand the issue there. Release the specialist report, release all the documentation around the treatment that he received. As Callum Skinner put it in his column that he wrote in The Scotsman, if you have nothing to fear, you've got nothing to hide.
I agree with that to a degree, and but the issue here is that we're in a situation where it may be that there's some other explanation that he doesn't want in the public domain, and so that's where this is on a real, you know, there's a real issue here about, you know, the right to confidentiality. But on the other hand, the credibility of his Tour de France win in 2012 is absolutely at stake here. And the more this goes on with unclear explanations or explanations that don't check out, the worse it looks. And it's become like a political story where the deed at the heart of it almost is forgotten. It's the kind of the explanations and the dots that don't join up that become the story. And that's where we're at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, what surprises me is just the crisis management or lack of crisis management. I mean, you can read any PR manual or manual about PR, crisis management, and the way you really need to anticipate crises, and you have to have measures in place that you can then employ should a story like this break. And it's just that the silence is inevitably filled by speculation, and there's been a lot of silence. There was a lot of silence in the first instance after the Fancy Bears leak, and there's been an awful lot of silence in the last few days after the story emerged about the suspect package. And, you know, as for the alibis, I mean, I was been reminded of scene from one of my favourite films, not the most highbrow film.
Happy Gilmore.
No, Wedding Crashers.
Oh my word, what a deviation.
Starring Daniel Freeman, Rob Hatch.
Yeah, there is, every scene in Wedding Crashers is a classic, but there is one in particular where they're in Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson are in a church, and you know, the whole premise of the movie is that they crash weddings on false pretenses, and they're in the...
Oh right, is that why it's
called? Yeah, yeah. And they're in a church, and you know, they're talking to someone else at the wedding, and they say, oh, how's... I think they reference Aunt Liz or someone, and they haven't even checked that Aunt Liz is alive, and it kind of feels like that. The Emma Pooley story...
Is Aunt Liz...
Yeah, she is, for the purposes of this story.
I mean, that's an odd one as well, because if you're going to... There's no love lost. I think that's fairly open secret, isn't it, between Emma Pooley and the British cycling hierarchy and Dave Brailsford. Why on earth would you choose Emma Pooley as an alibi? I think that my sense is that I think we know the way that Dave Brailsford works, that he was going through a process and trying to be transparent about that process with Matt Lawton, the journalist who was investigating this story. But in doing so, he, you know, made a few just odd decisions in terms of what he disclosed. And I think it goes back to that point. You either come out and you be fully transparent or you don't. I made a mistake earlier. I said, if you have nothing to fear, you have nothing to hide. It's the other way around, isn't it? If you have nothing... No, I said, you've got nothing. If you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. What I meant is... Oh, hang on. If you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear.
I think the thing that's worsened it is Simon Cope, who, you know, he's not a big player either in British cycling or in Team Sky. You know, he was a British cycling employee. He's was paid by British Cycling at the time. He's made this trip out to Geneva, we gather, visit the Dauphiné, and then back on the same day, taking this package, which he says is a jiffy bag. How credible? I find it really lacking credibility to say that someone would happily, even with an absolutely trusted employer, would say, oh yes, I'll take a jiffy bag to Switzerland and France for you without knowing what's in it. I mean, that's just worse than the way this all looks. I find that absolutely bizarre that this is the turn it's taken.
You know,
and
we were talking.
It throws such a spotlight on
it.
Yeah,
you know, we were talking. There have been so many parallels drawn with Lance Armstrong and US Postal as providing the sort of the template. And you know, it's tricky, isn't it? Because Simon Cope was an employee of British Cycling, who, as he said in his interview, would run a few assignments. There is this overlap between Team Sky and British Cycling. There was, certainly at the time, between British Cycling and Team Sky. He's a British Cycling employee delivering something to Team Sky. That's a world away from Moto Man. The comparison will inevitably be drawn, the parallels were made, but it's a world away from someone incognito riding in on a motorbike with a refrigerated box and blood bags in it. But the Team Sky are making it easy for their critics to draw these parallels because they're not offering up enough information or details to make to not leave these huge questions hanging in there. And for as long as these questions are in there, as you say, in the void, it's filled with speculation.
Yeah, I mean, looking back at the feature I wrote in 2011, a sort of diary of a week spent with Team Sky, on the final morning, the stage that went to La Toussuire, Dave Brailsford and I had a conversation about the UCI's new no-needles policy, which had only just come in the May, I think, just before the Giro that year. And that meant that all the teams had to sign up to agree that no medication or, you know, recovery could be administered by needles. And Dave Brailsford said to me that morning, almost unprompted really, that you know, there was nothing to kind of see here at this team, and he was firmly behind the no needles policy. And so, you know, when I'm sort of adding all this up and thinking he was saying and thinking that morning, and yet within a couple of weeks the TUE had been applied for triamcinolone, and it all starts to kind of merge together and provide a really sort of muddy picture of what was going on at the time. And I think the other thing is, without wanting to feed to conspiracy theorists, when you look at the range of individuals involved in cycling at the time, Pat McQuaid was the president of the UCI at the time. His son Andrew McQuaid now works for the Wiggins team. Brian Cookson is now the president of the UCI. His son, Ollie Cookson, was working for Team Sky at the time. You know, there were so many things all joined up. You know, you've mentioned the links between British Cycling and Tour Racing Limited, which was the parent company of Team Sky.
Lionel Burney was there on the spot.
Brian Cookson was on the board of Tour Racing Limited at the start. And there are all these dotted lines joining these people together. And on the one hand, that's because professional cycling is a very small world. You know, Anglo-Saxon professional cycling is an even smaller world. But on the other hand, there just doesn't seem to have been any kind of safeguarding when it comes to how this all would look when a story like this breaks. And it looks bad. And the question now is, was it bad, or was it just a series of unfortunate incidents that all add together to make it look as bad as it does?
Exactly, Lionel. I mean, I talked last time when we mentioned and when we discussed the TUE, the initial story, the kind of lack of rigour that seemed to have been applied by Team Sky when, you know, a team that's famous for its attention to detail and prides itself on its attention to detail. And, you know, as you said, the lack of foresight, how would this look, how might this wash if someone did, let's say someone had found out in July 2011 that Wiggins had the TUE for Kennecourt, a substance that's been abused for years and years. And, you know, think about the context of that time, 2011. You mentioned the no-needles ban in 2011. Other stories, doping-related stories that had broken in 2011. In the February of that year, Ricardo Ricco had almost died because of a botched blood transfusion. There was the Floyd Landis had just given a big interview to Paul Kimmage in which he laid out in forensic detail Lance Armstrong's doping. So Matt White had been sacked by Garmin for sending Trent Lowe, a Garmin rider, to a Spanish doctor. So it was incredibly prominent on the agenda in that period, much more so than it is now. So there was no excuse for any sloppiness. For a team that was newly launched, had claimed itself, had purported to be, you know, transparent, and so they should have shown the same rigour to any issue that might be construed as being linked to doping or medication as they were in every other aspect of their activity.
But, Daniel, don't you think that they would have regarded the TUE system, it wasn't particularly on our radar at the time, it is now, but that was that's a sort of separate issue to all these incidents you talk about. When you talk about Ricardo Rico storing bags of blood in his fridge and the
completely separate, but is there not a need in that context? Would they not perceived and been sensitive to the need to be white to the
white. Yeah, but it's tricky, isn't it? Because the whole thing about TUEs is this issue of medical confidentiality. And I know, Lionel, you know, when you talk to a doctor, a team doctor about TUEs, how much is it fair to ask? Can you ask what the substance is? No, you can't really, because the doctor is bound by confidentiality, patient-doctor confidentiality. I mean, can I just read a little bit of an email that we got? Because we carried on getting feedback, and we got an email from a doctor, Dr. Kevin McCarthy, who disagreed with some of what we said about TUEs. He said, I feel when a professional cyclist is racing, he's at work, I feel the area of occupational health is important. Cyclists have a right to healthcare. I disagree that if a person gets sick during a race, they should be denied standard medical care. I don't see how any other job in the world would allow the employer to deny the employee antibiotics, painkillers as standard medication. Your point on Grand Tours as being a test of stamina and health robustness is well made, but going by this logic, do you think the professional cyclist should be denied vaccinations as this would give them a benefit of immunity during a race? It is a grey area, and there's lots of complications about it. There's a very good discussion about this in David Epstein's book, The Sports Gene, about in American sports, for example, baseball pitchers having laser eye surgery. It's any kind of surgical procedure as in inverted commas, doping. It's such a grey area, and I think sport's still just getting to grips with this and how we manage the medicalisation of it.
I think those are all, they're really important and very interesting debates to be had. The problem is we're getting drawn into this, speculation about a package, a jiffy bag, being transported across international borders and nobody knows what was in it. And, the fact that British Cycling have said that it contained a medical substance but have also said it wasn't triamcinolone, we have to take them at their word there. We're in a real old mess here. And this is a mess, really, of Team Sky's making by failing to deal with this initially. And I've always think that the flaw in Team Sky's PR policy has always been to say the sort of expedient thing at the time. Give an answer to something and then, bat away the next question. And then when the next question comes, give an answer to that and bat that away. And in this case, it just hasn't worked for them because there are too many holes in the story. I mean, it's like a, it's like a string vest, the way this all holds together, isn't it?
On that note...
hung on very, very little. In substance, there is almost nothing. There's a TUE which was applied for through the regular channels and was granted through the regular channels. They haven't, contrary to what people have said, we don't know that they've broken any rules. It seems as though they might not have broken any rules. There have been various stories, theories that came out initially that you can't have a TUE for preventative medicine, and pretty much all asthma medication is preventative. So if that was the case, there wouldn't be any asthma medication on the TUE list. So there's nothing really at the moment to really taint Bradley Wiggins' Tour de France victory. But Team Sky are almost forcing us to doubt and ask questions.
They're making it easy.
Well, and also the scale of the coverage has pushed it to the forefront, hasn't it? I mean, this, as David Walsh said on Twitter, this is not going away. Somebody needs to front up and provide some proper answers that do hold water.
Absolutely. I've got an image in my head of sort of Lionel
me
and Ramsey Nesbitt
in
string vest. I think we're going to go out now, and you're going to drink as much Weiss beer as the Italian team are going to drink. B-dons on Sunday.
Well, I'm looking forward to a Berliner Currywurst. Now, I've come here for the beer and the sausages. I mean, and to bring Daniel his package, of course.
Yeah, we haven't come to sack Daniel as he speculated last week in the podcast. Some people ask questions about that. We can confirm that we haven't given Daniel his P45 yet.
Another rolling contract, though, isn't it?
Rolling contract. Excellent. We'll give him another chance. Right, listen, chaps. We'll reconvene next week to talk about what is bound to be a thrilling World Road Race Championship. We'll be back in London-ish, and Daniel will be in Berlin. So, in the meantime, thank you very much, Daniel.
Good night from the Schwarze Pumper.
Thanks for having us, Daniel. We'll
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.